This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. So Tim and I are just kicking around some of the headlines out there when it comes to the pandemic. Booster doses of COVID-19 vaccines. This is really, I think, the big one of the day, showing that they increased protection against both the Delta and Omicron variants in three studies that looked at infections, hospital admissions, and deaths in thousands of U.S. patients. I think that's a big one. And we're seeing, as you said, feels like things are peaking in New York City.
Yeah, they certainly are in New York City. But we should note Kathy Hochul, the governor of the state, said that pressure on healthcare facilities remains high. Mm. And we're not seeing it break evenly throughout the state, Carol. So what we're seeing anecdotally and through the data in New York City is certainly a good thing, but the state and the country have a long way to go.
All right, so let's see what Dr. Ian Lusbader sees right now, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone, back with us on the phone in New York City, as he does on most Fridays. Ian, good to have you back. How are you?
Always a pleasure, guys. Happy Friday. Hopefully
Happy Friday.
Everyone's feeling well. Carol?
Yeah, well, here's the deal. And all right,
he knows you're at home.
If you were my doctor, I would have said, listen, the day I took a rapid and a PCR, the rapid came back positive, the PCR came back negative, and then I've taken a bunch of rapids at home while I've been sequestering.
I think banished is the term from the office.
Yeah, Bloomberg banishes you pretty carefully, which is why we love their protocols. But I've had all then subsequent negative rapids. So I have had no symptoms. My family hasn't. So we are assuming I really actually didn't have COVID. Does that feel right to you?
You could have had a false positive. That's possible. Or you most likely were exposed, since everyone will be exposed along the way. And many people, you were in a position with a number of my patients. I had a test. I might have symptoms. I might not have symptoms. What do I do? I might have taken a test because I'm visiting a relative or I had the sniffles. You know, and really we treat everyone similarly, which is try not to infect other people, even though we know that people tend to be more infectious before they have any symptoms, you know, five or seven days before that.
Right.
And treat symptomatically, you know, fluids, bed rest, make sure your, you know, vitamin D levels are good and maybe a little zinc. And most people do well. And we've really seen that there probably is some benefit to vaccines, and that could be why in some people they have a very mild or asymptomatic, you know, course. We're seeing a lot of kind of cross currents. The UK basically saying, look, we're giving up on mandates and all of that. Let's just, you know, we give up.
Yeah, right.
Omicron, you win. And in Israel, you know, the fourth shot, they've really sort of a very selective group, elderly, you know, people or people with immunocompromised. But there were several studies out of the MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, a great journal if you want to subscribe to it. I can get it for you at a discount. It's MMWR is great. And they really review a lot of data. And they reviewed a few studies, which have complex titles, COVID-19 incidence and death rates among unvaccinated and fully vaccinated adults with or without booster doses during periods of Delta and Omicron. This was from April 4th to December 25th.
Right.
There are a number of studies. I won't belabor it. But they did show that, for example, the number of cases in the unvaccinated were about 6.8 million in this group, 2.9 in the vaccinated group. So definitely some reduction in cases and also a reduction in death rates, about 94,000 in the unvaccinated, about 22,000 in the vaccinated. So it does appear vaccines, you know, can be helpful, play a role.
Right.
Part of the problem in teasing out all this data is that there's an overlap of Delta and Omicron, and we know that the Omicron has more mutations.
I'm sorry. No. Forgive me, because I love that you were going through all of that. What I want to ask you, though, then, is how do I, like, sorry, I'm being really personal, but I'm trying to understand that. I mean, I absolutely had no symptoms. So do I chalk it up to a false positive? Is that likely on a rapid when everything else came in negative?
I don't believe so. I think you were, you know, you've got a child. You're out, you know, traveling around. There are many people who will be exposed, have really no symptoms at all. have a positive test. You just happen to catch it at a certain time. Granted, there are false positive and false negative tests. But I think you probably really were exposed. You know, your immune system is good. You probably had minimal symptoms. And some people just have even, you know, sniffles or a little cough. They think it could be allergies. But you did the prudent thing. And we can check your antibodies, you know, see if they're, you know, elevated. Although, again, there's a poor correlation between how high your antibodies are and sort of how much you're protected. But we're going to see a lot of this. As people are doing more tests, we're going to be getting a lot more positives. And people say, what do I do?
Sorry, Tim. My personal consultation with Dr. Lusbader.
No, this is great because I've been just under the assumption that you had a false positive, given that all the other tests, especially the PCRs, have shown that you were negative. Hey, Dr. Lusbader, before you go, speak to the anecdotal data and the actual data that we are seeing here in the Northeast when it comes to Omicron. Is this the end of COVID? We have about 30 seconds.
I think we are coming down in the next few weeks. The number of cases have peaked, in my opinion. Hospitalizations are under control. The people who are getting sick have comorbid conditions, diabetes, obesity, COPD. So I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. Not yet. I think we still have several more weeks. But I think in the not too distant future, we'll have new topics to talk about, unless we unfortunately get a new variant. I don't think we will. Yeah. But there's still a global pandemic. The rest of the world still has a lot of work to do.
We're looking forward to talking to lots of other things with you in the future. Fingers crossed. And hopefully you're doing well. You sound like you're getting over still your cold. Dr. Ian Lusbader over at NYU Langone on the phone in New York.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's talk about Peloton and Netflix a little bit further, because these stocks, these pandemic plays, they were, you know, rallying big time until they were not. So let's get to it.
Ed Ludlow is West Coast correspondent for Bloomberg News. He joins us on camera from our San Francisco bureau, so you can see him on YouTube right now. Ed, do you want to start with Netflix or Peloton?
You choose.
Okay, I'll choose.
I'm game to talk both.
Okay, let's talk Netflix here, because that's certainly the big
story.
Look, it's having its worst day in years right now. At one point today, at its lowest point, its worst day in more than a decade. It was a different company then.
Yes.
What are you seeing? What are you hearing from your reporting? What is happening?
A lot's happening. And, you know, last night, Netflix has its earnings call. And for the radio audience, I'm using my fingers to show inverted commas, because what they do is they dump a pre-recorded video on YouTube. And so you watch through it, you can record it, rewind. And something I picked up on, executives said they couldn't put their finger on, they couldn't pinpoint why subscriber growth has slowed or why it hasn't returned to pre-pandemic levels. They said they couldn't pinpoint it. But then they proceeded to give a very long list of reasons as to why subscriber growth has stalled. And it ranges from the macro picture, right? We always think about Netflix in the context of North America. We're guilty of that because I watch a lot of Netflix, guys. A lot.
You're not
and
alone.
I'm in America. Of course you... Exactly. But 60% of the company's revenue comes from outside the US. Regions like Latin America, where the economy is under much more duress than we currently have it in the United States. They are facing currency headwinds because of that business outside the US. And so they say that revenue will be down $1 billion in 2022 because of that currency headwind. It will also impact margin by 2%. But the main takeaway is competition. How many streaming services are there out there that we as consumers have a choice in right now? And what makes Netflix any better if the pipeline of content is delayed and we're not getting those new shows that we crave, like Bridgerton, until the end of this quarter?
You had to remind me. Soon. Hey, you know, first of all, you're looking great on YouTube. I'm watching you on YouTube.
Thank you.
Just search on Bloomberg Global News for all of you who want to see Ed as well. What's interesting, too, is, okay, so that subscriber number, a big bummer. They still have, what, 225 million global subscribers?
Yes.
I mean, that is, you were just talking about international. And, you know, our Gita Ranganathan saying that when it comes to content execution, you know, when it comes to foreign language content, they are killers. Look at Squid Games.
Yeah, I mean, look, as a student of the Bloomberg Terminal, right, all you can do is look at the data, and Netflix forecast first quarter subscriber net additions of 2.5 million. Mm-hmm. But the street was looking for more than double that. and the average analyst consensus estimate, right? They themselves in the prior quarter said they were looking for 8 million. So it's really hard to understand why their guidance was so off. What materially changed in the last month of 2021 and the first month of this year that they got it so wrong? And it's really hard to understand that because things are difficult right now with Omicron, with consumer behaviors, with inflation, but they're not so different today on the 21st of January than they were, say, at the beginning of December.
Hmm. Hey, Ed, in the last minute we have with you, let's talk Peloton.
Yep.
Yesterday, right. Just a brutal day for the company. We actually got a pre-release of earnings, but it shares are rallying by over 12% right now. Are analysts saying yesterday was the bottom for Peloton, at least this time around?
Yes. Yeah, so look, good data, churn. People are sticking with Peloton. I'm a Peloton user. I believe Carol's a Peloton mm-hmm. user. But go back to their prior earnings and look at the data point that shows the number of hours existing users are using on their bike. It's much less. And the same question for Netflix. What drives future growth? What brings new people that haven't used Peloton before back? And that's what they're addressing here. They were really honest in saying, cut capacity of production, scale back the number of devices that they're making, and reduce workforce. Because the growth they experienced the pandemic era is over, sadly.
Well, and I think John Foley, right, coming out, making those comments too about kind of a production, you know, resetting production levels for sustainable growth. I mean, we have to start thinking about what is life like post-pandemic, and some of those crazy growth levels aren't going to exist in a world that is reopening and we have different choices. Ed Ludlow, we love you. Thank you so much. Ed Ludlow joining us from our San Francisco Bureau.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The global cover story is about China and its second go-round as host to the Olympic Games in Beijing and how really, Tim, this time around, the world gets a very different China.
Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. Joel, before we get into this story, I want to talk the cover here. I'm holding it up. I don't know if, you can see it on YouTube because Ari is amazing and already has the cover up. But it shows Xi Jinping in first place with the gold medal on the medal stand, the podium. Talk to us about how this cover came about.
Well, we have been looking ahead at the Olympics for a while, which obviously aren't underway yet. And soon, I think everyone in the world will start talking about them. And so we had this observation, though, as we kind of marched toward opening ceremonies that, you know, not so long ago, opening ceremonies were in the exact same stadium in Beijing. That was in 2008. That was the Summer Olympics. Obviously, this is the Winter Olympics. And other than that, almost everything about China and the world, China's role in the world, seems to have changed really since that 08 moment. So we wanted to, just, as this little walk-up, talk about all of those things that have changed and China's role in it, and that ascendancy that, you know, putting Xi on the gold medal pedestal really represents.
Well, and it's, you know, it is a very different China. And I love that this story, Joel, gets into specifically the role of China in our global economy. Where it was back in 2008 is very different from where it is today.
Yeah. Keep in mind that back then, it was sort of like China was just really kind of coming to the world stage, and it was basically like getting crowned as a member of that community. And obviously, if you just even think about it from an economic standpoint, at that time in 2008, as John Liu and Janet Paskin write in the story, it had just passed Germany to become the world's third biggest economy. Now it is basically nipping at the heels of the U.S., and depending on how some of these next few years go, it could very well end up passing the U.S. even sooner than projected. And, you know, the catch here is, like, you know, for all the things that have happened to the U.S., you know, and actually just bears mentioning, 2008, right after the Games, that was basically when the financial crisis started to unfold. And I think one of the things that the story goes into is that China learned a lot from that financial crisis. Obviously, it affected China deeply, but it helped kind of mold their version of of capitalism, which obviously is slightly different than the rest of the world's version of capitalism. But they basically looked at all of that and said, hey, we could do something better than the West has ever done.
Okay, so they have that one. Maybe we give that one potentially to them, Joel. But, you know, when it comes to human rights issues, like, that is still this difficult relationship that the world is having with China. Like, we want you to be part of the global economy. We want to be able to tap your market. We want to have these relationships. But we have a real problem when it comes to your human rights issues and abuses.
So that's going to be, I think, the big tension over the next few weeks as the Olympics start to get going. And during the Olympics, I think we'll probably see much discussion of this. Obviously, China wants to frame that differently and say, you know, look, this isn't a human rights conversation even. You're trying to make it something different than what it is. And so I think we're just going to continue to hear more about that in the days and week ahead. But obviously, it's a sticking point and one of the reasons that the U.S. has taken the stance on the games that it is.
Well, we actually got a chance, Tim and myself, to catch up with Janet Paskin out of Hong Kong to talk about this story. And here's a little excerpt from that conversation where she talks about the future of China. Listen up, everybody.
It's hard to look beyond COVID is the honest truth.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at how China has done in the last couple of years and really the growth in its economy and this amazing recovery that they've been able to affect during the pandemic while everybody else has been in the doldrums, a lot of that is due to this COVID zero policy that they've had, where they have zero tolerance for any infection. That's kept people going to work. It's kept factories running. It has really minimized disruption to the role that China plays as kind of the factory of the world. They are sticking with that policy, but it is getting harder for them to do that, and that could really affect their economy in a way that we haven't quite seen. So I think that this is going to be a critical, critical year for China, for the Olympics, for the COVID zero policy, for its economy.
And that is Bloomberg senior editor Janet Paskin. Tim and I catching up with her earlier this week, Joel. And that's one thing we didn't even talk about with you. Like COVID, like their policy. Initially, we were all kind of, you know, thought China was onto something, doing it right. And now it's questionable.
And, you know, we're going to see, you know, with things like Omicron and like just the high level of contagion that are possible with it. You know, they had great success getting, you know, vaccines out. Those vaccines, TBD, how they hold up against something like Omicron. Who knows really what that looks like with large swaths of the population. So it's a big question mark. They have successfully become basically the last place in the world that could put up a border and not let anybody across. And here comes the Olympics, where they're going to have to let some people across because they're hosting it. Now, the last thing I'll just mention here on the Olympics is one other big difference between 2008 and now is back in 2008, a lot of people wanted to hold the games. Almost no one wanted to hold this one. So this was really, you know, China is left holding an Olympics that everyone else is kind of backed away from.
Hey, Joel, we only have 30 seconds left with you. I want to make a hard pivot here because there's so much good stuff in this current issue of Bloomberg Business Week. I have it in my hands. The social clubs in New York City that I've never been invited to, that I don't belong to. Am I going to see you at those?
You know, maybe after Omicron, I'm laying low for just a little bit longer. It had to go from extreme to high, and then I'm going to, like, you know, recirculate and be social again.
Okay, that, of course, is from our Pursuit section in the magazine Bloomberg Business Week. Joel Weber is editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. Hey, check out this new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's available on newsstands, on the Bloomberg, and at bloomberg.com/businessweek. Carol, we didn't talk about your happy place.
No, Anguilla. There's a story in that. There's also this amazing Ponzi scheme story that I feel like is going to come to a Netflix soon.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We just talked about, for some of our audience, about New York City Mayor Eric Adams confirming his first paycheck, which he gets today, will be converted into Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then we got that news earlier this week, Tim, about the Fed taking a big step toward the possible issuance of a U.S. digital currency. There's a lot going on.
There certainly is. For some updates on crypto and some analysis, let's bring in Todd Southwick, CEO of iTrust Capital. Todd joins us on the phone from Long Beach. iTrust Capital is a platform that allows people to buy and sell crypto through their IRAs. Todd, how are you?
I'm good. How's everybody? And thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, well, thanks so much for joining us. Eager to talk to you about this. I want to talk about iTrust Capital in just a moment, but I want to get your thoughts on what Carol mentioned. I wonder about legitimization here, because that's a term that we've heard a lot in the past couple of years when it comes to cryptocurrency, and certainly it's important for your business and your product. I'm wondering what it means to have the U.S. at a federal level talking about a digital coin, while at the same time you hear someone like Eric Adams, New York City's mayor, taking his paycheck in crypto. Just give us your thoughts on that.
I think there's a lot of people talking about crypto, and I think that's kind of the main takeaway. A lot of people compare this to the internet in the 90s. I think that's a great comparison because people don't know where it's going to be. So that would be my overall commentary on governments talking about going into cryptocurrencies and issuing cryptocurrencies, is that there's a lot of talk and there's not a lot of certainty. As we see from our side, we are working a regulated business, and the SEC is not giving much guidance. And again, I believe it's a lot of talk that just hasn't shaken out yet.
Okay, so how does the talk then turn into action? And do you think it actually does? I mean, look, Eric Adams, Mayor Adams, taking his paycheck in crypto, that's not talk, right? He's actually taking crypto.
Sure. I mean, we know that the SEC and the state regulators are taking the position now that they are going to move into regulation. So it's top of the lawmakers' minds. My point was just that difficult to predict where it's going to go. I don't think we'll be seeing digital currencies replacing dollars anytime in the next 5 years.
Well, having said that, so let's get into what you guys are doing. Todd, talk to us a little bit about your platform, because as Tim mentioned at the introduction, that you guys, through that platform, clients can directly buy and trade crypto, also gold, from what I understand, in real time, and do it through their retirement accounts. Tell us a little bit about how this works and also the volume and activity that you're seeing and the growth on your platform.
I mean, we're an interesting story in that when we started the business in 2019, crypto was not something people are talking about. Mid-pandemic in 2020, we saw the shift where a new type of customer was coming in. I think I saw some statistic recently that in 2019, the survey said that 1% of the U.S. population is interested in investing in crypto, and we're now up to 14%. So I see, we saw that shift in 2020, and our business, grew along with that. And the type of client that's coming in is different as well. We're shifting from people who are enthusiasts that, that are, smaller in numbers, obviously, to the broader market retail investor. And that's where we've been successful with our platform, that, we've taken the position that we're an investment platform, and the client we target is the retail investor who wants to make investments in cryptocurrency but doesn't want the headache or the fear of loss with custody. So with us having an all-in-one platform with institutional custody and allowing people to use IRA funds to do so in a tax-advantaged way, we've really been able to attract that new audience coming into crypto investing.
Hey, I wonder about who should be investing their retirement in crypto, and like how people should think about it. Because traditionally people think about their retirements in fixed income and equities. And I'm wondering, based on your research and what you're telling people, how much of that do you believe should be in crypto? And look, I know it depends on age. That's a big part of it.
I mean, it does depend on age, but I mean, our perspective as a company and from myself personally, is that we do not give investment advice. We provide maximum options to our clients, and they make the decisions on their positions and how much of their retirement portfolio to put in these accounts. There's there's plenty of independent analysis on how much cryptocurrency one should hold to be diversified. I think I've seen numbers like 5%. Obviously, people on our platform are investing at greater proportions because we're a cryptocurrency specialist platform.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about the other side of the business, right? Getting actual companies to sign up for this, because it's a business that relies on, and we only have about 30 seconds left. Can you talk a little bit about how interest has shifted over the last couple of years as we've seen the price upswings in crypto?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when there's periods of volatility, you see a lot of entry into the market. And when there's downward movement in prices, there's less interest in the market. So, we see higher percentage of signups, and a much
right.
lower transaction activity that, follows volatility.
All right. Well, good to check in with you and hear about what you guys are doing specifically. Todd, thank you. Todd Southwick, he is CEO at iTrust Capital, on the phone from Long Beach, California. This is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just got about 10 and a half minutes left to wrap up the Friday trading session, wrap up another difficult week. Certainly, if you were trying to be bullish in this market, it wasn't that kind of trade for you for the most part. Let's get to it with Alan Lance back with us, research director at lanceglobal.com, president of Alan B. Lance & Associates. He is back with us on the phone from Toledo, Ohio. Alan, how's it going?
Going well. How are you?
Doing okay. Trying to figure out, watching technicals on some of these major equity averages. How significant is it to you that we see an official more than 10% or 10% correction when it comes to the NASDAQ?
I think it's as far as really something that was overdue. We're seeing more and more excesses, and it's a situation where I think it's actually a positive for the long-term health of the market. If we continued, with the IPO and momentum craze of 2021, I think we'd have been heading ourselves up for another, 2000, with the dot-coms, et cetera. I mean, the valuations are better, but we're just getting to that extreme. So this is something that, I think is healthy for the market. It's well needed. And just like in the past, you find out that these pendulums swing to an excessive degree. So we might, see more of this, which I think is good. If you have cash, it's a good time to start redeploying the profit taking from the past quarter and utilize that cash to pick up some good bargains.
I mean, it's always hard to catch a falling knife, Alan. But when do you know that we've hit bottom? What are you looking for?
Yeah, that's the hardest thing, Tim. It's a situation where, in 2000, we bought way too early as far as in the financial crisis. We started buying in end of November 2008, and we're still buying in January, February when the market was still going down. What you have to do is really get to a point where you're comfortable with the valuations. We weren't a quarter ago, but now we're starting to get comfortable and buying. And what we're telling our clients is that it's a situation where you want to buy and probably go lower. We're not going to pick a bottom. We're not that smart. But, I think 2-3 years from now, these prices that we're buying, just like when we were buying in January of 2009, will really look, good. And that's the theme of, taking advantage of the volatility. And, if you don't have cash or you're in,
right.
Taking that extreme risk, I think it's a situation where, then it's some hard decisions. But if you've got the cash, now's a great time to gradually start going in. I still think we've got further you know, to go. There's a lot of headwinds for 2022.
Well, and we want to get into where you think we should be deploying that cash that you might have on hand. But I have to say, and I respect him so much, but is it really a falling knife that we're seeing? And I think about a conversation we had with Ben Kirby yesterday at Thornburg Investment Management, who talks about, yes, we've seen a run-up in some names. Now, every name in the market, not all areas of the market, have gotten overbought, though.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And there's those momentum stocks, you know, and I think the last haven was a mega, you know, cap tech, and now you're starting to see them, you know, crater. And I think that's what's really, you know, lost some of the faith into the market, and got a lot of new investors in that haven't seen something like this. So that combination with the momentum.
But Alan, my point is that, yes, there's some names that are just off the charts and they've had such a tremendous run, but there's a lot of names that haven't. And so I just wonder, as we see the major averages going down on some of those, really impacted by some of those high flyers, I mean, how do you see the market more broadly? It sounds like you see it rather constructively, as you said, because if you've got money, it's time to really deploy some of that.
Exactly. You know, if you look at the value, you know, you do have some extremes, like I think Procter & Gamble is fully valued, but you look at a Unilever or even a 3M trading where it was, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, even though their fundamentals have definitely improved, I think, you know, take advantage of the broader sell-off and accumulating some value. Obviously, energy has been a good example of what can happen in a market. You know, energy underperformed for 10 years, so now you've had a year and a half of outperformance, and that can continue for a while. So you're right, Carol, there are pockets of opportunity as opposed to the financial crisis. You know, internationals, everything was overvalued, and it was really, you know, hard to find a place to hide. And now there are pockets, and eventually the growth names, if they go down enough, which you know, some of them have, you know, can start to look attractive on a long-term basis.
We hear from the Federal Reserve next week, and I'm wondering, Alan, how you're thinking about the Fed and its first meeting of the year, hearing from Jay Powell in the press conference. Expectations, are you trading around it? How should our audience be thinking about it?
Yeah, I think that's just one of the headwinds, Tim, you know, that and the inflation, and even geopolitically, you know, you look at this and we hadn't had the pullback. You know, the market is, you know, at extremes in many areas, and then when you have the headwinds of higher interest rates, higher inflation, you know, it's going to be challenging after, you know, three great years. You know, I think it's just a matter of what we're doing is on the bond front, you know, to try to avoid, you know, try to own real assets, avoid long-term bonds. I think, you know, the yields are paltry and the loss of principal, you know, is significant, and you want just the opposite in the investment.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.